Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C. And you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time. And let's go directly to the panel. We are joined by a man whose political commentary and analysis can be found at Counterpunch and on his website, thepolemicist.net, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back as always.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Leon.
We're also joined by a widely acclaimed speaker, writer, journalist, and political analyst. He has traveled extensively in the Middle East and Latin America, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, as always, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Gentlemen, it has been reported that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's extradition is expected within hours, if not days. According to the Associated Press, a senior Ecuadorian official has countered the claims of a WikiLeaks source, saying that no decision has been made to force Assange out of the London embassy, but I believe that tweet has since been removed. What does this say about Assange, about a free press, about the power of the United States? Caleb Maupin.
Well, first of all, you know, rumors have been going around for a long time. We don't know what is going to happen. It seems pretty clear that there's some kind of negotiation going on behind the scenes. We don't know what forces are involved in that negotiation, but it seemed, you know, a few months back, like he was immediately going to be extradited, and then it didn't happen. He hasn't been online. We don't know exactly what's going to happen here, but it gives me the impression that there are forces that are not in the view of the public that are at play here, and that there are negotiations going on at a very, very high level regarding this. The fact that we keep getting the impression he's about to be extradited and then he's not, you know, there's a lot that we don't know here. Let's be real about that. But the point is that if Julian Assange were to be extradited and taken to the United States, this would be the first time that a publisher had basically been charged. And let's be real, Julian Assange, he did not leak anything himself. And everything that people gave him was true. All that Julian Assange has done is make public information that was given to him. And if they declare that, that's essentially a threat against any media in the United States. How is media, how is a publisher, a newspaper going to know if the information they've received is classified or not? I mean, this has a huge chill effect on the free speech of anyone in the media. And it's a case that everyone should be deeply concerned about. WikiLeaks has only published information that was given to it by others. It's not been going around and hacking anything or leaking government information itself. It's only published things that have been provided by sources. And if you then start jailing people for releasing information that was provided by sources, that opens some very dangerous doors.
Jim Kavanaugh.
Yeah, Caleb is absolutely right. I think this is a fundamental case for anybody who claims to be in favor of freedom of the press and free speech. WikiLeaks published, and material that WikiLeaks published was also published by the New York Times and the Guardian. They are a publisher of information they receive from other people. In the United States, there's no law against that. And this is going to be a litmus test for everybody who claims to be in favor of the free press. You know, the Democrats and the media were all up in arms against Trump for saying nasty things about a few reporters and CNN. This isn't saying nasty things. This is putting someone in jail for a long time. This is a prosecution, and it's outrageous. And everybody who claims to be a progressive Democratic presidential candidate should be asked flat out, will you end the prosecution of Julian Assange? And that answer should be yes, or it's unacceptable. This is going to be a very interesting situation if they arrest him. And I think that, you know, they're going to count on the fact that the media, which should be protecting him and supporting him, will not. You know, they're kind of going to be a little bit anxious about whether the traditional media will come around and say, yeah, we realize we have to support this guy. It's on our own interest.
On March 26th, WikiLeaks' Twitter account announced that President Moreno is being investigated by Ecuador's Congress for corruption, and this was sparked by what's called the INA papers leak. The same tweet referenced President Moreno's attempt to surrender Assange in exchange for U.S. debt relief. And that has also been reported by the New York Times. And I believe that it wasn't WikiLeaks that first reported Moreno being investigated. I believe that also came through other mainstream media sources. So there are those who believe that the threat of extradition, the fact that Assange might actually be removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, some are wondering if that's payback by Moreno. In this instance, Moreno might be shooting the messenger. I think people need to focus on the United States holds itself out as being a protector of human rights. And if a publisher of information and news cannot be protected, particularly in a country with a First Amendment that is supposed to be as strong as our First Amendment is, this is the height, to me, of hypocrisy. Caleb.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is a country that goes around the world lecturing governments about the need for more transparency, about allegedly violating human rights. I mean, all kinds of NGOs and nonprofits and the National Endowment for Democracy. And the United States has practically turned it into a business, the politicization of human rights. And now they want to go out of their way to jail somebody from another country, to basically seize somebody, you know, who's not even within their own borders, not even one of their own citizens, and take action against him simply for publishing information that was given to him by other sources. I mean, this is unbelievable. I mean, imagine that the New York Times had some kind of classified information about, say, Iran or North Korea, and then North Korea then, you know, extradited the editor of the New York Times and took them to their country and charged them for the crime of revealing their government secrets. I mean, this is pretty extreme. And there's no way anyone can look at the case and not see this as a huge threat to the civil liberties, most especially of people living in the United States, but really the freedom of media anywhere in the world. This is huge, and it's almost indefensible. But, you know, yet when you hear all the Democratic Party candidates speak, they're almost afraid. When the word WikiLeaks comes up, it's almost like they get nervous. It's very interesting. And at this point, we don't know what's going to happen. There are a lot of different potential narratives. And I urge people not to act as if they know what's going on when they don't have the facts. Don't try to write a narrative in your head. See what's actually happening, because there's a lot of things that are not really clear here. And we need to see what is actually happening. But the alarm bells are going off all over the world. There have been demonstrations of people speaking up and saying, you know, hands off WikiLeaks, hands off Julian Assange. There has been an upsurge of people. Now, it hasn't gotten highlighted in the mainstream press, but there has been an upsurge of people that are deeply worried about this case and the implications of it.
Jim, you know, I think it's always important for people to understand when they talk about Julian Assange, when they talk about WikiLeaks, that the information that WikiLeaks has released has been incredibly embarrassing to a lot of people in not only the U.S. government, but in allied governments as well. But no troop positions have been disclosed. No secret identities have been revealed. No harm has come. No physical harm has come to anyone as a result of this information being released. What's really been done here by Assange is the lies that Hillary Clinton and so many others in American government and other associated governments have told have been exposed.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear that, what Assange is being indicted for in the United States, as far as we know, and I think it's pretty good information, this part of it anyway, is for the information about the Iraq War, for the collateral damage video. It's not about, you know, the Democrats all hate him now because of the story that's being told about what he did and what WikiLeaks did reveal during this 2016 election. But that's not what he's being indicted for. He's being indicted for revealing the truth about the Iraq War. And at the time, everybody, including Democrats, was in favor of that. So, and at the time, the Pentagon said, no, nobody has been hurt by this, the Pentagon said that. So that's an important point. And we have a situation in which, you know, everybody should look at this and say, this is going to turn things around in a certain way. People are going to be afraid to report things if this guy is indicted and is brought to jail and is tried you know, reporters all around the world will suddenly say, wait a minute, I could be, as Caleb says, this is the United States, again, exercising kind of extraterritorial legality. You do something over there, we're going to force, because we control governments around the world, including the British government, and they'll send you to us. we'll try you and indict you and prosecute you. And it's really a kind of horrible thing if this happens, and people should be aware of it. Unfortunately, the media, the mainstream media, which claims to be part of the free press, has not been interested in this and really doesn't like Assange and doesn't want to take his side. And we're going to have to see whether they do or not.
The next story this week, some of Mueller's team say report was more damaging than Barr's letter revealed. And to me, this is a really, really goofy New York Times story. It's reported a number of places, but the way that the Times reported it, in the New York Times story, there's a lot of baseless allegation made by unnamed sources. Yesterday, the Times reported that some of Mueller's investigators have told associates that Attorney General Barr failed to adequately portray the findings of their inquiry and that they were more troubling for Trump than Barr indicated, according to government officials and others familiar with their simmering frustrations. This to me sounds a lot like hearsay. And then today in the Post, they write, revelations that Special Counsel Mueller III's still confidential report may contain damaging information about Trump ignited a fresh round of political fighting yesterday, ushering in a new phase of the nearly two-year-old battle over the Russia probe. That's from the Washington Post. Caleb, your thoughts on this?
Well, it's like this narrative that Trump is somehow working for Russia and that his election was the result of a vast Russian plot and that there's Moscow gold and Soviet satellites and, you know, Boris and Natasha sitting there in the Kremlin twirling the mustache. And it's all this narrative is so vital to what the Democratic Party has been saying over the last 2 years. That this seems like desperation to keep it alive. It really does. And that, you know, Rachel Maddow, it was reported that her views significantly decreased after the release of the report. And that you know, even though we have Van Jones saying that it was a nothing burger, that the voters don't care about it, that your average rank-and-file Democrat is concerned about health care, education, the rising cost of college tuition, the minimum wage, you know, the increasing level of police brutality and the decrease of civil liberties in the United States, the average Democratic Party voter is not sitting there going, oh, I better vote for the Democrats because the Russians control the Republicans and I hate Russia. That's just not what people care about. But there has been just a clinging to this narrative by the Democratic Party establishment. And you can almost see it as the Democratic Party thinking this is their chance, right? For years, the Democrats were accused of being soft on communism. For years, the Pentagon, I mean, we know, you know, you go back to the Carter administration, how the Pentagon thought Carter wasn't with them. And a lot of leaders of the Democratic Party probably think this is our chance that we can get the Pentagon and the neocon war lobby on our side. We can prove that we're the more loyal entity. We can call the Republicans the Russians, the traitors. They think this is their one chance to finally be the ones accusing the other side of treason. So it's like some forces in the Democratic Party just don't want to give this up. And that's all there is to it. And it won't die.
It won't die. Jim Kavanaugh, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a zombie. I mean, this is getting, well, it's getting even more ridiculous now. I mean, these dissatisfactions that were expressed in the Times article and the Washington Post articles were explicitly not about the Russian collusion thing. They were about whether or not there's enough evidence for obstruction of justice, da-da-da-da-da. So it's you know, there's nobody saying that contesting that the Mueller investigation cleared Trump of any U.S. person of conspiring with the Russian government during the election. But they're hanging on to this. They had demonstrations in New York yesterday where they were singing songs calling Trump a Russian whore. I mean, this is lunacy of the highest order at this point. And, you know, it is something, as Caleb says, what are they getting out of this? I had a conversation with a friend from Western Pennsylvania last week, a woman who organizes the Democratic Party. They're leaving the party. People are leaving the party. You know, all those people left the party between 2008.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
are still leaving the party. Has Russiagate helped that? You think that's bringing them back in? You know, this is, the Democrats have done nothing but increased Russophobia and imperialism, created a McCarthyite hysteria that drives a demand for censorship of independent media, and tried to hold on to their base with this stuff that the base is not interested in. In the meantime, all this is, and it's just going to increase this, is giving Trump a big political gift. He's failed, and he's reneged on his promises. That argument can be made to people who voted for him. He raised taxes on the wealthy. He's not ending the wars. He's not bringing back the jobs. Instead, Russia, Russia, Russia. He's a Russian agent. And as Caleb says, nobody listens to this anymore.
Here's an interesting line from today's Post story that makes me wonder if pressure to release the report is the motivation for the stories. Quote, "The developments put additional pressure on Barr to publicly release Mueller's 400-page report in its entirety and prompted objections from Trump and his allies that Democrats are attempting to politicize what the president believes has been a 22-month, quote-unquote, witch hunt." And what I've been hearing, and I think you all would agree with me on this, is when Barr's letter came out and it wasn't the damning proclamation that for the last almost 2.5 years we've been told we were going to get, then the narrative shifted to, well, you have to release the whole report. We don't know what to do unless we get the whole report. And so I wonder if that a sentence that I read, which came out of the Washington Post today, that the developments are putting pressure on Barr to release the report, if that's really the or at least one of the motivations behind these stories. Caleb.
I mean, it very well could be. And I mean, we should expect, I mean, there's going to be redactions in a document of this kind. I mean, there's going to be. But then every redaction, that'll be a further argument. Mm-hmm. Still don't have the full story. And then, you know, there's talk of, you know, well, we need to open up another kind of investigation, right? We've done a criminal investigation with a special prosecutor. We need to do an intelligence investigation. There are many, many ways to keep this going. And I fully expect certain forces in the leadership of the Democratic Party to do everything they can to keep this going. And I don't think we're going to hear the end of this, unfortunately. And for every new thing that comes out, there is some hole, there is something that hasn't been released, there's some angle that hasn't been explored. And this is going to be kept alive. This has a lot of value to certain forces. It really, really does. There's a fear that Donald Trump, you know, has an alliance with some kind of faction that wants some level of detente with Russia. Meanwhile, if you look at what's just happened with the NATO anniversary celebration, and I mean, it was a hate Russia fest if ever. I mean, they were talking about all kinds of stuff, and the Black Sea and the Navy, Georgia and Ukraine, and I mean, this is intense. This is an intense moment. I mean, if Trump is trying to prove to the world that he is not an agent of Russia, he's doing a very, very good job of it, because, you know, relations between the two countries right now are not good. And it seems like, you know, the idea that Trump would be an ally of the Kremlin is completely outrageous. And there's an escalation of tensions that we've seen right now. But facts don't seem to matter to those who want to push this narrative.
Jim, your thoughts. Again, it seems to me as though one of the motivations behind these stories could be mainstream media trying to pressure Mueller to release this report, which he says he's going to do. And to Caleb's point, there are going to be redactions in it, because I venture to guess there's going to be some secret stuff in there that they don't want people to know about.
Full report is never going to be released. It can't be. There's always going to have to be redactions. There are names of informants. There's derogatory information that's uncorroborated. It's the law prevents this from being released in a complete unredacted form. And they know that, okay? And as Caleb says, but any redaction is going to be, oh, we didn't see all of it, so maybe there was the secret knowledge. You know, but this is silly at this point. As Caleb says, what Donald Trump has been doing in terms of policy towards Russia has been everything that Russia doesn't want, attacking them in Syria, attacking Venezuela, attacking Germany to try and get them out of the Russian pipeline. I mean, these are serious things. And building up NATO on Russia's border, these are very, very serious things the Russians see as threatening to them. So there's no factual basis for the idea that Donald Trump is taking orders. And I heard it yesterday from Cenk Uygur. Trump is taking orders from Putin because Putin has some blackmail on it, some financial blackmail, you know, and therefore in some way he's taking orders. I mean, this is just lunacy. And I don't know, you know, but the Democrats, it's a replacement for politics. It's saying, you know, we can't fight the political battle. We're going to try and throw out these things which are going to keep people riled up without giving them any political substance that's an alternative to what Trump is doing. Run on Medicare for all, run on progressive taxation, run on ending wars. You know, this is force them to answer those questions. Instead, they're letting him force them to say, why have you been hunting me for 2 years? You did nothing came of it.
Run on some substantive policy. Wow. What a novel idea, Jim. That's novel. I got to talk to you offline about that. Hey, folks, it's Friday. Dr. Wilmer Leon here, and this is the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik, and I am joined by my panel, Jim Kavanaugh and Caleb Maupin, and we have another panelist that's going to join us on the other side. So stay right here. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and it's Friday, so that means that it is panel time, and we have with us a political commentator and analyst. You can find him at thepolemicist.net, Jim Kavanaugh. We have with us acclaimed speaker, writer, journalist, and political analyst, Caleb Maupin, and we are now joined by communications strategist and media consultant, Michelle Hudgens. Michelle, thank you for joining us, and gentlemen, thank you for staying with me.
Thanks for having me.
Ethiopian Airlines pilots followed Boeing's safety procedures before the crash, according to yesterday's report. Boeing, the world's largest commercial aircraft manufacturer, is being investigated by the Department of Justice in response to two deadly crashes less than 6 months apart. The company's best-selling plane in the world, the 737 MAX 8, has crashed twice in the past several months. The first was Lion Air flight leaving Jakarta, Indonesia in October, and the second was an Ethiopian Airlines flight that left Addis Ababa, Ethiopia in March. The report that was released yesterday laid out a timeline of the flight based on analysis from 18 Ethiopian and international investigators and information from the jet's flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder. Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg yesterday apologized for the, quote, erroneous activation, end quote, of the company's maneuvering software in two 737 MAX 8 passenger jets. And, quote, we extend our sympathies to the loved ones of the passengers and crew on board Lion Flight Air 610 and Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302. He says, we own it. It's our responsibility to eliminate this risk. We own it, and we now know how to do it. Jim, your thoughts?
Yeah, this article in the Times was quite startling. I mean, the image there, they have a graph of, you know, this software that forces the nose down runs off of one of the, what they call, angle of attack sensors. There are two. And that sensor just gives the wrong reading. And then it forces the nose of the plane down. And it's very hard to compensate for that. And in fact, according to this, you know, the pilots did what they were supposed to do to compensate for that, but it didn't work. So this is just a stark fault in this system that should never have been put out like this, put into service like this. It's a symptom of the fact that they allowed Boeing to certify their own planes. This is what now Trump is talking about, allow the pork producers to certify their own pork. You know, I mean, this is, you know, part of the system of let the companies regulate themselves, and it doesn't work very well, and it's costing a lot of lives here. And I think Boeing is going to be in trouble for this.
And Michelle, it's interesting that not only Boeing is, they're under investigation from a couple of different entities, the Department of Justice is involved. That is an incredibly, incredibly telling sign. Your thoughts?
You know, I think it's telling for one of two reasons, because, you know, first, it's saying that there's a failure on the part of the administration, the FAA, to, you know, do its job, which they're certainly trying to protect themselves against. but then also indicates that, you know, there's a greater problem than even we as novice would even begin to understand in terms of what Boeing has put in place. Because I read another article that talked about potentially another system factor that also could be contributing to the crash as well. So it's a multi-layered factor. And I think at some point, as much as Boeing has begun to own the original era, like this is a era on multiple proportions on multiple levels, and the Justice Department getting involved indicates that not only is it FAA worried about their own duplicity in the situation, but they're also worried about what this means for the industry as a whole, which we all need to start thinking about.
Caleb Maupin.
Well, when I look at this, I can't help but put this in a historical context, because there has been decades and decades and decades of disregard and just blatant disregard and throwing away of the lives of Ethiopians for the benefit of the military-industrial complex in the United States and the wealthy forces in the United States. You can go back to the U.S. covertly supporting Haile Selassie and his repressive regime and backing him against Eritrea. And then you can go back to then when there was the rise of the Derg, which was a pro-Soviet government, and how the USA then flipped its position and started supporting Eritrea and supporting kind of an armed campaign against the Ethiopian government. More lives lost. Then you can go back to how it is now. And I sat in the halls of Congress, and I heard testimony from people that talked about the torture that's going on today in Ethiopia. The Ethiopian government, backed and supported by the United States, has a pretty ugly human rights record. I mean, there's a whole history of the people of Ethiopia basically having their lives taken and being just kind of used, you know, and thrown, having their lives just thrown away to further the geopolitical advances and interests of the USA and the big corporations in the United States. And it's such a tragedy. Corporations like Boeing, weapons manufacturers, so many Ethiopian lives have been lost. The country has been kept in utter poverty by years and years of covert actions by the United States. And it's really just, this is just the latest chapter in that ongoing saga of just brutality and suffering that's been imposed on the people of this very wealthy African nation. This was the first Christian nation in the history of the world, you know? Ethiopia is a people with such a vast history of civilization. When my ancestors were living in caves in Europe, Ethiopia was a vibrant, vibrant civilization. I mean, it's just a horror what we've done to that country. And this is just kind of the latest episode, long history of U.S. atrocities against the people of Ethiopia.
Jim, I've said this before, but I think this is a perfect example of this point. And that is, we keep hearing, particularly on the conservative side, that we have to deregulate, 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 deregulate. Regulations are just choking off productivity and prosperity. It takes too long to bring pharmaceutical drugs to market. There's too much red tape in getting the newest version of the widget on the market. And we've got to be sure that it just costs too much to certify that pork and beef is safe to consume. There's just too much regulation. And what gets lost in that whole conversation is, yes, on the one side of the equation, regulation is impacting business. But on the other side of the equation, regulation is saving lives. The human element here, the life in the conversation, seems to take secondary concern to the profits and the proceeds for the Boeings of the world. Jim.
Yeah, well, this is what's happening. I mean, you know, this is regulatory capture, where the regulatory agencies are captured by the industries they're supposed to be independent of and overseeing, where they're actually consider themselves really kind of partners and departments of those agencies, and where the idea is, as you say, that we've got to get things to market, and that we have people in other countries bringing things to market. We've got to get them to market first. And those things, especially when they're airplanes and pharmaceutical products, you allow no independent, you know, in other words, the certification process is not done independently by a real public agency, but is public agency cedes that authority to the private profit-making industry that wants to get that to market as quick as possible. You are going to have these kinds of problems, and they're deadly. And this is part and parcel of a kind of right-wing libertarian, let the market act as quickly as it can, do what you can for the market, let the private industry make its decisions.
You know, Michelle, final point here, and we'll move on. Hearing Boeing say now it's our responsibility to eliminate this risk, we own it and we know how to do it, is an incredible turn of events and an incredible change in perspective from the earlier conversations about, no, we don't need to ground the plane, we're waiting for data, as though two flights dropping out of the sky within a five-month period, killing over 340 people, as though those two data points weren't enough. They needed to wait for more data. I just find it very interesting that in a very, very short period of time, we've gone from we don't need to ground the planes because we don't have enough data yet to it's our responsibility to eliminate this risk. We own it and we know how to do it.
Well, I mean, clearly that's an exempt for Boeing to protect their bottom line. You know, they have 17 years of history or 17 versions of, you know, Boeing airplanes that they're trying to build upon and maintain their business. And if they don't begin to own the narrative, and, you know, I think about it from a media or PR perspective, if they don't begin to own the narrative, then when they actually do have the solutions, then they're going to continue to hemorrhage the losses. And so they're trying to stop the bleeding at this point. This really isn't about necessarily them claiming responsibility because they're operating as a good faith partner in this, a public-private partnership, if you will. This is really a case of them trying to protect their bottom line, remain a business, a viable business entity, and certainly to make sure that they're going to be able to produce in the future. Because right now they've got, you know, an entire industry that's relying on these planes that are just sitting on the tarmac collecting dust and certainly not helping anybody's bottom line. So, you know, Boeing is being blamed not just for this failure in terms of what it means to them, but what it means for all the other airlines that are dependent upon it, what it means for all the other individuals who apply the parts and pieces for it. So Boeing's got to turn this around from a number of levels before they start to get a number of lawsuits, not just the ones from the families, but from the other industry partners and then also from the federal government, especially considering the Justice Department is already looking to be involved.
Caleb, your thoughts as we get out of here on this one?
I just can echo what everyone else says, really, what was said by the other two guests, being that, you know, that the idea that regulation is the problem. This is something that has seeped into the culture. It's been very, very widely promoted. These kind of, you know, these ideas that the government is the problem and more regulation is always better. As there's a lot of money has been put into just inculcating that into the mind of the U.S. public. When you look at a case like this, it's just blatantly clear that the opposite is the case.
The next issue, Congress invokes powers to challenge Trump on war in Yemen. Rejecting a plank of Donald Trump's foreign policy, the House late yesterday, invoked never-before-used powers to demand that the Trump administration withdraw support from the Saudi-led war in Yemen. As senseless war, and this war is a senseless war, that has resulted in what international aid organizations have called the worst man-made humanitarian crisis in history. The Senate passed the same resolution in March with bipartisan support, and the president is expected to issue a veto of the measure. This will be his second. And Congress, at least at this point, does not have the votes to override it. Caleb, your thoughts?
You know, the more you know about the war in Yemen, the more it's not complicated. Everyone looks at the situation in Yemen and says, oh, boy, that's very complicated. You got Houthis, you got, you know, this, that, and it's complicated. It's so complicated. It's not really that complicated. Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the world, and it is basically fighting to take control of its natural resources and basically of its own government. And that's what's taking place here. This is not, they want to make this into an ethnic conflict or a tribal conflict, but the Houthis are one faction, and they have many, many allies. There's the Southern Movement of folks who want to break away the South and make it into an independent country like it was, the Democratic Republic of Yemen. You've got former President Saleh and his supporters. You know, it's a broad coalition of Yemeni people who don't want Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia's Western allies to run their country anymore. I mean, this is just a basic fight for national liberation. Yemenis of different religious backgrounds, different tribal backgrounds, secular forces, religious forces coming together and basically saying, we don't want the Saudis to treat us like they're their backyard anymore. We don't want to be a colony any longer. We want to run our own country. That's what's going on here. And the logic of supporting the brutal, repressive monarchy of Saudi Arabia in trying to stop the Yemeni people from basically getting together and writing a democratic constitution is pretty outrageous. This is a continuation of the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring uprising, it happened in Yemen. It brought down the government. Saleh stepped down. And then after the Arab Spring, this vibrant uprising demanding democracy, you had a sham election, and you had, Mansour Hadi just kind of as the only candidate on the ballot declared, this puppet of Saudi Arabia declared to be the leader. And many people in Yemen were not satisfied with that. And the spirit of the Arab Spring and the demand that they be able to govern their own country and not have some Saudi puppet dictator imposed on them continues. The way the American media reports on it, they make it this really, really complex thing. They make it sound like this is some kind of longstanding religious tribal war we just can't understand. And then you get like your neocon war hawks that want to make this into the idea, well, Iran is secretly trying to take over Yemen. This is all a big Iranian conspiracy. That's just not the reality. This is Vietnam all over again. This is a people fighting to break away and establish their national liberation. It's that simple.
You know, NPR's Rachel Martin spoke with Congressional Representative Brad Sherman, Democrat from California, today regarding the House resolution and the vote. Listen to this question from Rachel Martin and listen to Congressman Sherman's answer. And then, Michelle, we'll take your thoughts on this. Here's the audio.
The Saudi-led war in Yemen has been going on for the past 4 years. So why is Congress only acting now?
Two reasons. One, report after report of terrible bombing mistakes, and makes us wonder whether they were even mistakes, hitting school buses, weddings, etc. But what really did it was Khashoggi, the brutal death of that journalist in the Istanbul consulate.
Jamal Khashoggi.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, Michelle, to Caleb's point, the senseless nature of the atrocities that have been committed, the bombing of those 40 children, the vaporizing those 40 children on that school bus and the senseless murders of all of these civilians, that really wasn't what pushed the vote over the top. It was the killing of Jamal Khashoggi by Prince Bonesaw.
I heard that comment, and when it was first mentioned, and it just kind of left me shocked, because it's like, so the one journalist was a problem, but the rest of it was the cost of war. I think, for me, as I've been continuing to listen to the discussions around this piece, it kind of, to me, boils down to, Congress is very concerned about our president's international policy and his willingness to introduce us into a lot of situations, scenarios that could lead us down a path that the Congress is not interested in us being in, or for the people of this country are not interested in being in. And that there are a number of domestic issues here at home that need greater attention. So I think, if anything, this is, one of those warning shots across the bow that, like, they're saying to the president, don't try it, because we are willing to step up and let you know that we understand our role and our power. So let's get it together and get in check about what it is we're going to do on an international policy front. I feel like a lot of times they feel like he's gone too far, or he's not gone far enough, or he's gone on his own. And so this is really less about this particular Khashoggi issue, or even the whole issue in Yemen. I think it is more about, we're establishing our authority and power as you begin to establish your own. And I think that's where in a couple of weeks, we're going to hear this is about. And Khashoggi, just like the rest of the Yemeni people that are being tortured and killed in this senseless war, are going to see that we really don't have a vested interest there and have no interest in really being there. And it's not about them at all.
And Jim, to Caleb's putting this in a historical context in terms of the Arab Spring, it's also important for people to remember that this whole fiasco started under the presidency of Barack Hussein Obama.
Yeah, well, it is, the Arab Spring itself is more complicated than people thought. Every country was not the same, and the different things going on in different countries. Caleb is absolutely right to talk about the relationship historically between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Saudi Arabia has always considered Yemen kind of its backyard. It was very wary of any. There was a revolutionary southern Yemen, as Caleb alluded to, which was a state which
had revolutionary socialist ideology. Saudi Arabia hated that. They're wary of anything coming out of Yemen. They want to keep control of Yemen. And whether it's directly or not, whether it's in this horrific way or not. And I think what's interesting, you know, as you say, when you cite this fact that that Brad Sherman's saying, well, it's about the Khashoggi thing. I think, you know, I'm going to say this. The United States is not going to stop supporting Saudi Arabia on this. And they're not going to override Trump's veto. And this is a signal maybe to Mohammed bin Salman, Bonesaw, as you call him, that, you know, you've got to start being a little more careful about what you're doing. But the United States is not going to break its ties with Saudi Arabia even over this war. It's a signal. It's saying, you know, we want you to listen to us, to be more careful. We'd like them to maybe tone down the war, stop the war. There's nothing in it for the United States. There isn't. And they would maybe like MBS to say, you know, back off, and we can have a negotiated settlement with this. The Houthis, when they took over, were willing to have a coalition government. Not a matter of that. And it's also important for Americans to notice that the arms that are going into Yemen fighting against the Houthis are going to al-Qaeda. These are the part of the fighters for Saudi Arabia, the al-Qaeda in Yemen. So it's something the United States, certainly the American people, have no interest in. And the United States government only interest is they don't want to break entirely with Saudi Arabia, and they do want to help Saudi Arabia keep Yemen under its influence.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. It's Friday. That means it's panel time. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and we're joined by Michelle Hudgens, political commentator and analyst. We're joined by Jim Kavanaugh. We're joined by Caleb Maupin. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and it's Friday. That means it's panel time. We've got Michelle Hudgens, Jim Kavanaugh, and Caleb Maupin. Thank you all so much for staying with me. Lori Lightfoot, Chicago's incoming mayor, ran as an outsider. Lori Lightfoot, she won Tuesday's runoff against Tony Preckwinkle, a longtime politician who leads the county board in Chicago as well as the local Democratic Party. They ran, actually, when you looked at their platforms were incredibly similar. There was very little difference, really, between the two of them on policy issues. Michelle, is this another data point in regards to the success of an alleged progressive agenda in our national politics?
Wow, that's a good question.
Well, thank you.
I think if you're checking boxes in terms of, you know, minority, female, her sexuality, she's a lesbian. I just wonder, though, but are we really getting any more progressive? I mean, she says she's an outsider, but she did, you know, run the commission that examined the police force. She did step down from that. She was a prosecutor, but there's still a known entity here that, like, you know, you can't get but so far outside politics and still be connected. I don't know if it actually does check the box. I'm anxious to see the people she, you know, won in all 50 precincts, districts. So I'm sure that the people are hopeful. And certainly her agenda is one, as you mentioned, is very similar. But, you know, in terms of getting rid of corruption, reforming the police department, and certainly making investiture into all the communities and not just the affluent communities is on a progressive agenda. But how can she accomplish that? You have a 50-person council that is required to definitely work together and is going to have to do more about collaboration and negotiation. So ability to deliver on a progressive agenda is different than is it not for a progressive agenda. And I think that, to me, the jury is still out on that.
Caleb, is this a matter not so much of a success of an alleged progressive agenda? Could it be more because Chicago politics are incredibly unique? Is it Chicagoans thumbing their nose at the machine mechanism within Chicago politics?
Well, it very well could be that. the Democratic Party seems to be held back by the urban political machines and their legacy, whether it's the Daily Machine in Chicago or Tammany Hall here in New York. It seems like, you know, that aspect of the Democratic Party seems to be where it is weak, where people associate the Democratic Party with, the way government jobs are handed out in urban areas, with the way, there is mismanagement in a lot of government areas, you know, and whether you go to Philadelphia or New York City or Boston, you know, when people associate the Democratic Party with that, they don't particularly have a high opinion of it, even though they may agree with its policies. But it's also worth noting that this is the age of the outsider more than anything. If you want to lose an election these days, it seems like the sure way to do that is to get up and say, I am the status quo. I am just exactly the place. I'm going to give you more of the same. And no matter where you go, Republican areas, liberal areas, if you get up and you say, I am the voice of the status quo, I'm going to keep things exactly the way they are. Vote for me and everything will stay the same. You are going to lose. You can guarantee that. We are in an age where people are unsatisfied, want to try something new because they are not happy with the way things are.
Same question to you, Jim. Is this an alleged progressive agenda? I mean, I was shocked that the African-American community in Chicago voted for a very clear lesbian candidate because African-Americans are incredibly progressive. But when it comes to social issues, particularly those of sexual orientation and whatnot, the tendency is to be incredibly conservative. So is this a machine politics rebuff, or is it just one of those things?
Well, I think that's what Caleb was saying, essentially. It is a rebuff of the status quo. My impression is, I hope I'm right, that the social conservatism of a lot of African-American church-going politics is changing, and they're much more willing to vote, obviously, in this case, for an out lesbian. That's a good thing. I don't know anything about Lori Lightfoot besides what I read today. What I'm seeing is that, as you say, she doesn't seem to come from that radically different a background from her opponent. She was not exactly outside of the Chicago political machine. She was in and out of it. But she's running and portraying herself as someone who's going to reform, as a reform candidate. And, you know, we've seen these things in throughout New York City politics, essentially, the reform candidate, you know, doesn't necessarily mean a super progressive thing. What's also interesting and is an example of the fact that people want to throw the bums out, whoever the bums are, they're not really throwing the bums out, they want to think they're throwing the bums out, is that they also elected a bunch of socialists, the DSA candidates, to the city council. So, you know, you've got this all around the country, you know, people are, as Caleb says, fed up with the status quo, and they want to believe that they're going to vote someone in who's going to do something radically different and change things in a way that makes a better difference in their lives. And I don't know whether anybody's going to be able to do it because, you know, as the Times article about Lori Lightfoot says, at the end of the day, she has to run into the fiscal issues of running a city and paying for it. And that's something which is going to be very difficult for anybody to do. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the exchange and the chemistry between her and these new socialists on the council and where that's going to go.
Let me quickly shift gears. We have just a couple minutes left. In Venezuela, Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed interim president of Venezuela, who is backed by the United States government as the U.S. tries to impose a coup d'etat in Venezuela, he's announced tactical actions that will be taken by his supporters starting tomorrow, April 6th, as part of his Operation Freedom, which is an alleged grassroots effort to overthrow the democratically elected president, Nicolas Maduro. Caleb, quickly, your thoughts on what we're going to see tomorrow starting April 6th?
What we're going to see tomorrow is made for Western media. I can guarantee you that. They'll be doing everything they can to make sure this plays very, very well on CNN and furthers the narrative CNN is pushing about the evil dictator versus the freedom lovers. I doubt it'll change very much in Venezuela's domestic politics, but it'll make some good PR for the Venezuelan opposition around the world as they continue to try and get more support, even though they don't have very much within Venezuela itself.
Jim Kavanaugh, tomorrow, April 6th, starts Operation Freedom in Venezuela. What do you think? What are we going to be watching tomorrow on the news?
I really have no idea. I think Caleb is right. It's going to be stunts oriented for the Western media, who will all be there with their cameras to cover it sympathetically and excessively. And, you know, as we've seen this report from Whitney Webb about how, you know, this is being orchestrated in relation to American institutions that have an idea of these red teams, which are possibly armed teams that are planted around the country that incite revolution in some way or another. I don't quite know how this is going to work out. I don't think it's going to work out very well for Guaido, but we're going to have to see how it plays out.
And it's very interesting, Michelle, that Marco Rubio has said that the arrest of Juan Guaido would amount to a coup, even though the democratically elected president is the one that's actually there. But also the National Constituent Assembly, the ANC, has lifted the immunity of Guaido, opening the door for him to be charged criminally. So we could be headed to a showdown depending on how this stuff tomorrow starts to jump off. Your thoughts quickly, please.
I mean, I think I agree with what everyone else has already said. I think we're looking at Wag the Dog 2, Trump Goes International. I don't know, you know, what we're going to see, but certainly our interest in it is just going to be even more fascinating, and how much of our primetime viewing are we going to see from it?
Caleb, were you surprised that the National Constituent Assembly lifted the immunity of interim President Guaido?
It seems to me like they would very much like something to be done to him to give a justification or a pretext. I think that that's what the issue there is, more than anything. At this point, it's very hard to convince the world that Maduro is a dictator when Juan Guaido is running around inciting people to overthrow the government and being recognized as the president by foreign powers. You know, if somebody did that in the United States or any other country in the world, they would be immediately arrested. But yet, you know, I mean, he's being recognized by foreign powers. He's running around telling people to rise up, not to recognize the government, revolt. Rebel. He's been ordered not to leave the country. He's left the country. He's then come back to the country, not been arrested. I mean, he's doing everything he can to flaunt the laws of Venezuela, and the Maduro government is allowing him to do it. And yet the international media is then telling everyone Maduro is this brutal, repressive dictator. Oh my gosh, the people have got to be free. Juan Guaido is walking proof that that's not the case. So if he were to be arrested, that would then, you know, maybe make the narrative a little bit easier to swallow for those who look into the actual facts.
Let me stop you there. That's the voice of Caleb Maupin. We were also joined by Jim Kavanaugh. You can find him at thepolemicist.net, as well as Michelle Hudgens. Michelle, thank you so much. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.